supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Unfortunately, school shootings seem to be much more common now than they were a decade ago. So why is this happening, and can anything be done to prevent or even predict it? We'd all like to oversimplify, and we in the media are wont to do that kind of thing and say, well, it's about a broken mental health system, or it's just about gun laws, or it's about schools, or the economy, or parenting, or politics. But the truth is that unpacking this is anything but simple. We've got several distinguished guests with us today to try to sort out this complex and critical issue. We're joined by Dr. Peter Langman. He's a school-based psychologist, based in Allentown, and author of the book Why Kids Kill, Inside the Minds of School Shooters. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dan.
We're lining up Dr. Richard Friedman, who should be joining us a bit later. He's a professor of psychiatry and a frequent contributor to the New York Times Science section and Sunday Review. And his article, his very recent article, is entitled Why Can't Doctors Identify Killers? And we're going to be talking a bit about that article also. Later on in the show, we're going to hear from Noelle Ann DeSantis, who's a mental health DA for Mental Health Court System here in Philadelphia. And we'll hear from Mo Kennedy. He's the executive director of the National Association of School Resource Officers. And, of course, we'll be taking your calls. Have you had a personal experience with school shooting or school shooters? Has a friend of yours or a friend of yours' child been a victim? We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. So, Peter, let's start with you. I'm going to read the opening paragraph in Richard Friedman's article.
Okay.
He said, mass killers like Elliot Rodger, he's the one, of course, that recently had this mass shooting, I think it was 2 weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, teach society all the wrong lessons about the connection between violence, mental illness, and guns, and what we should do about it. One of our biggest misconceptions, pushed by our commentators and politicians, is that we can prevent these tragedies if we improve our mental health care system. It's a comforting notion, but nothing could be further from the truth. Peter, I'd like to hear your reaction to that.
Okay, just a couple things. To put it in context, there are seemingly a lot of school shootings and other types of mass killings in the news. However, in a nation of hundreds of millions of people, these are still statistically rare events. And the vast majority of citizens, as well as the vast majority of people with mental illness of whatever kind, never pick up a gun and become killers. So yes, some of them who do pick up a gun and commit rampage attacks do have one or more various kinds of mental health problems. However, changing the mental health system in the country, I don't think would be as effective as teaching schools how to recognize the warning signs and engage in threat assessment procedures so that they can prevent potential attacks by knowing what to look for and what to do when they see it.
I want to get to those warning signs in a minute, but I'm told we've got psychiatrist Richard Friedman on the line with us. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I just quoted your opening the quote from your opening, sorry, I'll get this right. I just quoted your opening paragraph. Woo, that wasn't easy. From your May 28th article in the New York Times. Well, and I want to follow up with you on that article, Richard. Surely, with early and more effective intervention, we can diminish the frequency of these events.
In theory, yes. I completely agree with, I heard the tail end of your other guest. I think it makes a lot of sense to educate the public to recognize the, you know, the so-called red flags or the warning signs. The problem is, I mean, just on a statistical basis, just practically speaking, it's not a reason not to do it. I think we just have to be aware that there are many, many, many people who will meet criteria for these warning signs. You know, young people who look upset and angry and disturbed, who say things that, you know, sound menacing. In other words, the system will be flooded with false alarms, false positive alarms. That may be something that we want to accept as a society. I mean, if everybody pays very close attention to their classmates and friends and looks for warning signs that are tip-offs that somebody is at risk of hurting themselves or hurting somebody else, in this case, sure, we might catch a few. But again, just if you think about the probability that somebody actually is planning a terrible massacre, I mean, these are extremely rare events in population sense. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. I mean, it's 0.13% of all homicides. You know, we're talking about 1 in 1,000. So it's highly improbable. I don't think it's likely to yield much, but we should definitely make every effort to teach, you know, educators, classmates, families, everybody involved. But not only that, I think we have to go further. In this case, you know, in the case of a California shooter, the police came to his house after being called by his mother, and they essentially looked at a snapshot of this guy who was able to pass off appearing calm and normal without going any further than that. They took a snapshot. So not just the lay public, but I think, you know, police enforcement has to be involved in recalibrating how they respond to, you know, threats.
Well, I don't know. You know, you point out rightly in, I think it was that article or something else you wrote, that, you know, somebody intervening, I mean, even a mental health professional talking to someone for 15 minutes isn't going to get a lay of the land. Even 30, often, you know, all of our experiences, you have to sit with someone for an hour, and then you find that the story seems to unravel. They can't seem to hold straight. But none of us can expect, you know, a 911 call, a policeman to sit with someone, to have the time or the skills to do that. Peter, I want to hear you weigh in on this.
Okay. The process of what's called threat assessment goes beyond having that 15-minute conversation with someone. And this is a growing trend both in secondary schools as well as higher education in this country, for institutions to train a team of people in conducting a threat assessment. And if you just rely on the potential perpetrator, he could very easily talk his way through it, just as Elliot Rodger did. But threat assessment also involves talking to other people, whether that's teachers, guidance counselors, parents, friends, because often there's been a lot of what's called leakage, where people leak their intentions or brag about what they're going to do or try to recruit a friend to join them. And if you do a comprehensive threat assessment, you're much more likely to detect those warning signs.
Well, what was missing with Elliot Rodger and this very recent school shooting, I think it was Friday at Seattle Pacific University. This is Aaron Ybarra, I think is how we pronounce his last name. He had called 911 on himself several years ago, saying that, you know, he wanted to hurt himself and others, and they intervened. I think he was even hospitalized for a while, and he got a job working on a shooting range. So, you know, what needs to be done to manage that? I mean, talk about leakage, Peter.
Right. In some cases, there's been sufficient leakage, either in the form of terroristic threats, or there's been illegal behavior in the form, for example, of kids getting guns illegally or building explosives. And sometimes people know this, but they don't report it to anyone who could act on it. And if you can get law enforcement involved, suddenly you have a much better chance of getting to the bottom of things, because they can do a search warrant if necessary. They can confiscate a computer, you know, check the hard drive, check the websites the person's been visiting, and perhaps accumulate sufficient evidence to take action.
And then what? Richard, what's your take on this? And then
My view is that the emphasis that we're placing on protecting detection of people who are likely to harm society is misplaced. Of course we should do everything we can, you know, use all the science and epidemiology we can to perfect, you know, make as good the detection of threat. But the other side, which is, I think, where the emphasis needs to be, is, you know, every society has, you know, a population of sick individuals and bad individuals and people who are bad actors. We all have had Adam Lanzas. We're always going to have them. Every society has them. What's different about our society compared to other industrialized nations that are comparable, and the reason why we have so many more of these mass killings, is that people have the means to translate their impulses into deadly action, meaning access to firearms. That, it seems to me, we cannot predict human behavior very well, much less change it. What we can do, I mean, I'm not saying we can do it easily politically, but what makes a lot more sense to me is to change its expression. You know, when I was growing up, the worst thing that would happen if you had a bully in school or somebody who's picked on, there'd be a fist fight, or someone would take a bat and hit somebody. Now, the same human impulses, exactly the same, human nature has not changed. Those human impulses are now being used and expressed using firearms.
Well,
people have access to them in a way they did not in the past and in no other country.
We're going to be talking about that a good deal later on in this show, and what needs to be done ideally and what can be done realistically. I also want for our listeners to listen to this show and get a feel for what they can do, if anything. The last thing I want, and Richard, I think the last thing you wanted was for people to read your article and walk away and feel helpless and hopeless. I trust.
I certainly don't want them to feel that, but I also don't want people to place the emphasis in the wrong phenomenon. I mean, absolutely, they should do everything in their power once they have a sense that somebody is at risk of hurting themselves or someone else, of reporting it to the proper authorities, whether it's the family, mm-hmm. whether it's friends, whether it's teachers. There's no question about that. But that, I do not think that's sufficient.
Let's go to the phones. We've got a caller on who sounds pretty concerned about something. Pamela?
Hi.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I have an adopted son who was adopted at 8 months with problems right from the get-go. He was a product of rape. We have repeatedly, through the years, tried to tell people something's wrong. And I'm telling you, he hurt cats. He tried to set cats on fire. He tried to suffocate his baby sister. We weren't allowed to lock him in his room at night. DHS came and issued a little warning or whatever that is. It was the mom. I wasn't used to a boy. I can't even begin to tell you all the things that we heard.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he urinated in drawers because
he
was angry.
Who have you spoken to?
Everybody. And when I say everybody, I've taken him to psychiatrists. I've taken him to school counselors. I've taken him to counselors. I've taken him to DHS. I have beat my head against the wall. Now, he is 13. Finally, I got one police officer to listen to me, and he was wonderful. And he said, I've seen this. And I said, listen, he's charming. He's attractive. He is not what you see. I am not the bad guy here. And the police officer said, I want you to spend 2 weeks and write down every single thing he says and does, which was, I'm going to murder you, Mom, you're a whore, blah, 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 blah.
And then what?
So I did. And he actually, he's been put in like a home for boys twice. He's very, he behaves very well in them. He comes home. They say, he's fine. We did it. He's fine. Within 2 weeks, he completely starts all over again. This last time, he was taken because of this police officer, and he's in George Jr., and they're working with him. I don't have a lot of faith. They're going to send him home again, and we're going to all live in fear. My daughter doesn't sleep at night.
All right, wait one minute here. I'm going to put you on hold. Don't go anywhere. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back, and we're going to have not only our guests answer it, but we're going to bring on Noel Ann DeSantis, who I mentioned earlier is the mental health DA for the mental health court system in Philadelphia, and perhaps she can shed some light on what options are for you in your county. So hang on, we'll be back in just 60 seconds. We're also talking with Dr. Richard Friedman, a professor of psychiatry and frequent contributor to the New York Times science section. Peter Langman's a psychologist, and his most recent book is Why Kids Kill: Inside the Minds of School Shooters. And we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Is this an issue that's touched your life personally, or are you concerned about your school? You feel at risk in your school. What would you like them to do? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at IamConcerned.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family with psychiatrist Richard Friedman, psychologist Peter Langman, and now we're joined with Noel DeSantis, who I mentioned earlier. She's the mental health DA for the mental health court system here in Philadelphia. Noel, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And hopefully we've got Pamela back on the line. You hang around with us, Pamela?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, good. Now, I want to tell you to catch you up here, Noel, that Pamela was saying that this policeman, you know, she did all she was supposed to do, and he was hospitalized a couple of times involuntarily, and now he's about to get out. Where was he placed, Pamela?
They're trying to get him out. He was at Devereaux twice. And now he is at George Jr.
Okay.
He's only there because we got serious help from a police officer who didn't listen to anybody else but us.
Okay. And tell me what county you live in, because I'm watching Noel nod her head. She knows of these agencies. What county are you in?
Chester.
Okay. Noel, what can you do to help this family?
It seems as if once he was placed and somehow DHS got involved, that he was in the juvenile system. And Devereaux is an excellent, I've sat on mm-hmm. boards with them in an excellent facility. But what it seems like, and the caller is saying, is George Junior Republic, which is further out by Pittsburgh area, would be a longer term facility that would deal with juvenile delinquents that have committed a crime. And her son, unfortunately, who has some psychiatric issues that at least she noticed a lot earlier than most parents would do, and that she was trying to get him significant help. So he's gone from a 302 or an involuntary commitment or commitment by the police into the system that way. But there is going to be the long-term help. He should be evaluated to see if he should be able to have case management hearing, case management, other individuals that would be able to help her with more support to get him into those places.
I want to just say two things. Don't go anywhere, Pamela. I want to say two things here. First of all, I should say that Devereaux, in addition to being an excellent resource, is also one of our funders, so that disclaimer to make those that be happy. The other thing is, Peter, I want to bring you on here and ask you, and maybe you too, Richard, like, what's the state of the art? What, you know, do we know enough in terms of psychotherapy interventions to really help this young man, or do we just need to keep him safe or keep us safe from him? What's the state of the art, Peter? Let's start with you, because
no, a lot depends on the individual. You know, I've worked with potential school shooters and other potential killers, and there's a big difference between those who recognize the problem and want to get help and those who deny that there's an issue or want to blame everybody else for their problems. So if, you know, the client sees that, you know, he's at risk for doing something he doesn't want to do, then you certainly can help someone get past that.
How do we do that? Let me turn to you, Richard.
How do you do that with a 5-6-year-old, though?
Well, I think, you know, the answer about what to do really comes from understanding what the nature of the problem is, meaning what's the diagnosis. You know, when you think about treating any problem, first you have to know what the problem is. And with this young man, although it's hard to render a professional opinion, you can't without having a lot more information and seeing somebody. But, you know, if somebody has, you know, a behavioral problem, which he obviously has, a conduct problem, and he, you know, has been cruel to animals and he's made threats, you know, it makes you worry that he's at risk of harming people if he hasn't already done it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this could be someone who has a personality disorder. It could be someone who has that and another psychiatric problem that's not really being treated, whether it's drugs or depression or an anxiety problem. But, you know, and those are treatable, and if they're not treated, they can make everything else much worse. In the absence of a treatable psychiatric problem, meaning, let's say, this individual has, you know, a very severe personality disorder, you know, the best sort of treatment is constant surveillance. And I'm glad that this mother, who's in this terrible situation with a wrenching problem, has involved all, you know, everybody around her, whether it's a combination of the police and mental health care system, so that they are not alone in struggling to deal with this very, very difficult kid who really has to have the impression that everybody is around and available to help out, and that they know that he's an issue and he's a problem and that he's being watched, that, you know, he can't be left on his own. He needs to be constantly involved in treatment.
I want to bring in both Peter here and Noel. And Peter, with your skill set, which is different from Noel's, what can the two of you do to help Pamela? What are the resources? What's the state of our science? And Noel, what are the legal options for Pamela? Start with you.
Okay,
Noel.
In terms of that, because he's a juvenile, there is a juvenile mental health, you know, facilities that would be able to take him, and a lot of that's going to deal with how the judge is handling things in the dependency side. Because the mother got DHS involved, they have an open case, and the judge can make rulings on the child's placement or custody while under DHS. In the adult side, that's exactly why we have mental health court, which your speakers are saying, absolutely the first thing they have to want to be get the treatment. They have to be committed to knowing they have a mental illness and that we're here to help them. That's exactly why we have mental health court, for the wraparound services, that positive reinforcement. At the same time, they have to accept responsibility, but there's treatment teams, there's special probation officers, there's a special judge that deals specifically with the mentally ill, a special prosecutor as myself, and as the case proceeds through the system, they can have, you know, small hiccups where they need to be redirected, and we can have a couple sanctions, which you sit in the jury box and watch court. And you could also have where you go to jail for a little while and come back out into different placements. But that positive reinforcement when they're doing well, to show you're always going to have this mental illness, how do you live with it, and how do you be a productive member of society, and how do we treat you, still have compassion, still get justice for that victim.
And what about kids? We're talking about a 13-year-old, and maybe I need to direct this to you, Peter.
Could I say something?
Yes.
I just want to say that, and I appreciate everything everyone's saying, and we've heard it, and I'm not meaning to be sarcastic at all, either, but we have tried everything. We have two other children, and we were literally quarantined to our house for years because we couldn't take them out of our house. You can't watch a 5, 6, 7, 13-year-old 24 hours a day. We weren't allowed to lock him in his room. He's dangerous. We were told that nothing could be done until he actually hurt somebody. And I literally said to them, so when he murders his sister, then you'll do something. Now he's where he's been. This is the third time he's been taken, and he's excellent, and they're saying he can come home. Everything's fine. Positive reinforcement doesn't work on him. Negative reinforcement doesn't work on him. He doesn't care.
So what
he could murder his father and not blink an eye. And I'm not kidding. And no one believes me. I guarantee you will read about him before he even hits adulthood. He will have shot up something. I guarantee you.
So there's no question that you are furious at the system, and rightly so.
I am.
And you're put in a position of helplessness to take care of your family here. I mean, it's
exactly.
Just an awful, awful position. A 13-year-old is not going to have insight. A 13-year-old is not going to acknowledge his illness or say, I need treatment. The one thing we're learning, Peter, is let's take what Pamela said just at face value, that where he is now, he's doing well. So what I would deduct from that is maybe he thrives under great structure and rules and supervision. Maybe that's where he thrives. Can we use that information to help him and help his family?
Possibly, if he's doing well because he requires that level of structure, that could be used to, you know, build a course of treatment for him. However, there's other possibilities, as Dr. Friedman was saying. You know, if he has a severe personality disorder, he may simply be very good at controlling himself when he needs to. And he knows
what
to say, and he knows what to do to get himself out of there. And
If
that's the case, then I think anyone working with him needs to understand that dynamic, needs to know that this person is very good at what's called impression management, how to make a good impression when he wants to, and not to buy into that presentation, and to know how to look
and
more deeply into the potential danger he represents.
And
almost every counsel we've worked with has bought into it.
All right, well,
over and over again.
All right, we're not done with you yet. I'm Pamela, I'm going to push our guests even harder. Because now you got me upset. So let's see if anything can be done for you and this young man. Noel?
Have they ever filed criminal charges? Obviously it seems like what the caller is saying
recently,
is about threatening
recently he
No,
he came after me.
Okay.
And
Did you call the police and did you file a complaint?
Well, it wasn't super severe, but the police officer who came was the one who finally helped me, okay. And that's why he's where he is.
Because there's a criminal case?
Yes.
So that's how
he got... He threw a stone through a window and he runs away and... But
the threats against you were more serious.
All right, so let's hear what the options are now that he's got to...
Well, that changes where he's in the juvenile system. He's not in the delinquency. He's not in the dependency track. He's in the delinquency track. So the fact is, he doesn't just leave George Junior Republic without a judge's review and without a judge saying, I believe he can be stepped down to what's known as aftercare probation or support. He'd have to have maybe another placement to go to that's maybe not as secure as George Junior. A judge makes that determination of how they change their levels of supervision.
Where does the judge get his counsel on this?
The judge would get his information from, obviously, the treatment center, would present an evaluation or report, would also get in the juvenile system.
All right, wait a minute, Pamela. Let's hear what Noelle has to say.
The juvenile system would be behavioral health evaluations or a mental health evaluation, and that's when guests like your doctors would be ones who would be evaluate and review him and give their opinion. But clearly, the mother being so involved must constantly keep reiterating to the judge, and she sounds extremely dedicated and sincere, that just what your guest speakers are saying, that he can manipulate, he can do that impression for a good period of time and say, this is not, you see my child as a judge for maybe a half an hour. This is my child 24/7, and I know them better than anyone. And that's what she needs to impose upon the courts and a juvenile probation officer. All these different people are where the judge will get their decision, how to make their decision from, all these different avenues.
Peter, let's suspend political correctness here for a minute. These resources that Noelle's talking about, what is the level of skill of the people who are there? I know it's an unfair generalization, but from psychiatry to technician...
Well, you know, I would say, without talking about any particular place,
right,
that having worked in a number of mental health settings over the years, my impression is you have a lot of very well-meaning people who do not often have the resources to do the best job. So they may be stretched too thin. They may be, you know, overworked, underpaid, not enough staff, and so on. So that's a general impression.
And
just want to say one more thing about this particular kind of challenge. Again, my overall impression is that when people are trained to work as mental health professionals, they are trained in suicide risk assessment as a matter of course. My impression is very few people are trained to do proper threat assessment, homicide risk assessment, and so on. So even if someone is referred to a mental health professional for that type of evaluation, unless you're sending the person to someone with a known expertise, that evaluation may not be adequate.
But in this instance, it's threatened the mother. It's threatened violence. There are foundations for them to be able to take it out of a suicide threat to someone who is abusing animals, who is threatening their loved ones,
right,
that are caring for them.
Absolutely.
Is there any way Pamela could turn to either or both of you for help?
Yes, she can get me. If she wants to stay, I will follow up with her case to see in the juvenile system where it is.
Peter?
I can't provide personal services, but if she would like to talk to me offline, that's certainly fine. I'm not in the Philadelphia area, but I do consult with people as these cases come to my attention.
Pamela, we've given you no answers, but what we have provided you with was two people who you can reach out to.
Okay.
And I hope you've got
one added notice. He has his own attorney. The system gave him an attorney who fights for him that he's good and
a child advocate. Because a child advocate, because you were the victim, that they would have someone independent. But if you stay on the line and give me your information, I'll follow up with your case number.
Okay.
And I will personally give you my number at the DA's office. And I do not handle juvenile cases. I do all adult cases, but I know the supervisor's there, and I will personally walk down the information.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you so much, Pamela. And I know I really pushed you Peter, and I pushed you, Noel, and in a way I want to apologize, in a way I don't. You know, yeah. this is a woman who's desperate for help, and you know, I kind of cut you out of the discussion also, Richard, but you know, I want to focus on Pamela. And let me before we take our break, I want to turn to you, Richard, and you know, apropos of what just happened here over these last 10 minutes or so, mm-hmm. you know, I think it's your job and my job as mental health professionals in the media to make the public more aware of these warning signs and options without stigmatizing those with mental illness even more than we do. What's your take on how we accomplish that? And do you feel you've got a responsibility to do that?
Right. Well, I mean, that's in part why I write. It's to communicate these things, to educate the public, to explain that mental illnesses are medical illnesses that affect the brain and the mind, and that they are treatable, and that there's, you know, no reason to treat them, you know, any less seriously than other medical illnesses. I mean, it's just that it's behavior that's affected. I would say in this case, the one thing that we should do is to make it very, very clear to the mother that, you know, they have to do everything to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. They should not have weapons in the home. They should, you know, of course, the police know this, but, you know, this kid should never be, you know, permitted to buy a legal weapon, you know, and, you know, to be absolutely sure that they minimize the risk of, you know, harm to themselves at home, because he may be able to get one.
Yeah, and I do think that's a good point. Well, I want to thank all three of you so far, and I don't want any of you to go away, because there's so much more to talk about. We're talking about these mass school shootings and shootings in general, and how we can predict, how we can protect, or if we can. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you are touched by what's going on today, give us a call if you've got a personal story. Or if, you know, you feel your school's not doing enough, you'd like them to do more, tell us what you would like to see your school do. We're talking with Richard Friedman, a professor of psychiatry, frequent contributor to the New York Times, and actually what triggered this whole show was his May 28th commentary for the Times entitled "Why Can't Doctors Identify Killers?" We're also joined by Peter Langman, who's a psychologist in the Allentown area. This is what he specialized in, and he's the author of "Why Kids Kill: Inside the Minds of School Shooters." And we're here in the studio with Noelle Ann DeSantis, who you've heard from. She's the mental health DA here in Philadelphia. We're also going to be joined in our third segment by Mo Kennedy. He's the executive director of the National Association of School Resource Officers. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
I'm Robin Young. The great creator of New York's Central Park and Boston's Emerald Necklace, Frederick Law Olmsted, came to landscape architecture late in life.
He was part of one of the transcendentalists. So everything Olmsted did, he did with an eye to how we could improve American society and make it more democratic.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about school shooters, whether it can be identified early, whether it can be prevented, or how we can protect our children and ourselves from these violent and potentially violent people. Peter, your career began at Children's Psychiatric Hospital in 1989, and this is when Columbine happened. Columbine, and 10 days later, a boy from Columbine was admitted, and you had to evaluate him and to see if he was at risk for homicide. What was the state of the art back then, and what about now?
Okay, just a couple details. It was 1999, actually, that Columbine occurred.
My mistake.
And I did not see a student from Columbine, but a student, 16-year-old boy, who was seen as a potential Columbine-type killer. He had a hit list, and he was engaging in some very disturbing behavior. So he was admitted to the hospital for evaluation, and he was the first of a fairly steady stream of such young men and sometimes young women who came through our facility, and I would, you know, evaluate them and make recommendations.
So this is apropos of our last caller and what her son might grow into. And it's also apropos of Richard's earlier point about how screening can get a lot of kids in difficulty who shouldn't be in difficulty. So how did you evaluate these kids, and how effective were you? Do you even know?
Well, going back to your previous question, the state of the art back then was rather primitive. 1999, there was not much research on school shooters and warning signs and threat assessment and so on. In the years after that, a lot more has come out. So, you know, as a profession, as a specialty, people engaging in violence risk assessment have come a long way in the last 15 years. Overall, I think most of the people admitted because of potential homicide risk were, in most cases, actually potentially dangerous people. Occasionally, I saw someone who I thought was admitted, was not really necessary, and, you know, we would make recommendations, get the person back into the community as soon as possible. And regarding your last question, none of the people admitted who I worked with as potential school shooters went on to commit school shootings. So that much I can say.
I wonder if the state of the science is improved significantly since then, our predictive skills, because Richard, you said that our ability to predict is not much better than chance. And, you know, when I was a graduate student, I was taught the best predictor of future behavior was past behavior. And that, boy, that's not good science.
No. I mean, you know, we know a fair amount from the MacArthur data and from large epidemiologic studies, you know, what factors seem to be correlated with violence, but obviously there are many other factors that we're not measuring that are very important in mediating the risk. I mean, you know, for example, we know being male, being young, abusing drugs, being psychotic, those are relatively potent risk factors for violent behavior. Yet if you were to, you know, pull together 100 people who just had the risk factors I mentioned, you know, the vast majority of them would not be violent. So obviously we're missing something. And in part it's very complicated because it reflects a mixture of many, many different factors that are, you know, social, psychological, and biological that come together in the perfect storm. You know, somebody may have all those risk factors and, you know, contingency plays out in a certain way that, it just so happens that they don't have an outburst of violence, or, you know, somebody is nice to them one day and, you know, the whole thing is headed off. We're just not very good at predicting violence. So, you know, even if these people show up at our door and we can talk to them and evaluate them and they're honest, let's say they actually do open up and tell us what they're thinking and feeling, some of them will have suicidal impulses or homicidal impulses. Most of them will not go on to act that way.
Let me ask Peter to very quickly weigh in on this, because I I want to get to prevention in schools, and I want to speak with Mo Kennedy about what his project is doing. So just respond to Richard's point, Peter.
Okay. Speaking broadly, whether it's about society or a particular high school, to predict on the basis of demographics or other information who might become violent is essentially impossible. However, the notion of threat assessment is based on responding to actual behaviors. And when you read the stories of many of these school shooters, what's really disturbing is how many times they told people exactly what they were going to do. They talked about their plans. Kids saw them with guns. They were accumulating firearms, sometimes explosives. They wrote about this on their website. They wrote about it in journals at home, that there was so much evidence to suggest they were at least at risk for committing violence. That in the face of that kind of evidence, you know, people need to recognize it and respond.
Well, let's ask Mo Kennedy to respond to this issue. Mo, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. I'm told you're calling from Guatemala on Skype. Do we have you there?
Yes, I'm here, and I'm actually calling from Morocco.
Morocco. Gotta love technology. Anyway, could you please weigh in on this issue? What can we do for kids who are showing these risk factors in school?
Well, it's interesting. We're here training SROs in Morocco, and we were discussing this very issue at the end of our training today. And, you know, one of the things that...
Let me interrupt you, Mo. When you say SROs, you're talking about school resource officers. Yes, and
I am. I apologize. Yes, school resource officers, especially trained police officers who work in schools.
Okay, go on.
So so, you know, the thing that we were discussing is that the issue of there are relatively very few of these incidents on school campuses, but when they happen, certainly they're high profile and they're awful. So one of the things that we want to make sure is that school resource officers are trained in how to respond to those situations tactically, certainly. But the bigger issue that we see in regards to the role that school resource officers can play in this is through building relationships. And in many instances, we've found where school resource officers have effectively built relationships with not only students, but parents, students, as well as teachers, then people have been much more forthcoming with information when they feel comfortable with that particular officer that they can share it with them.
Well, tell us about the training. I mean, there's an awful lot of skills that have to come into play here. What kind of training do they get?
There definitely are. Of course, we're talking about typically veteran law enforcement officers, officers who have already worked in the field for at least 3 years, hopefully, and some much more. And so what our training does is to certainly add an element of how to work effectively in a school environment. For instance, we have a block of training on special education, not to create special education experts. We're not out to do that with law enforcement officers, but more the issue of helping them to understand some of those concepts. We also train within that area on adolescent emotional issues. Just, again, some tips that could be very helpful for these SROs. We encourage them to work closely with school counselors, closely with school administrators. Those are some of the elements of the training.
I'm curious, who pays for this? You know, both police generally around the country and public schools are almost impoverished institutions.
Well, it really is a variety of means. Some have been fortunate enough to get grants from the Department of Justice to fund the project. In other communities, it's funded both through the law enforcement agency and the school district. We'll sometimes see something along the lines of a 50-50 split. It really is another element, a specialized element of law enforcement, and the funding comes from a variety of sources.
You've been doing this for 20 years. Tell us about results. Have you done any research on results?
Well, our organization has actually been around for 24 years, and we've done a great deal of training. We recently produced a report called To Protect and Educate, which is a pre-download from our website. And in that, you will find some pretty solid research and data on the effectiveness of SROs and some of the differences that they have made. We actually have an updated report coming out this fall to that.
Well, I do appreciate the work you do, and I especially appreciate your calling us from Morocco. So thanks so much for your time and for the work you do. We're gonna have a link to your website up on our website. So thanks so much for joining us. That was Mo Kennedy. He's the executive director of the National Association of School Resource Officers, and that's called NASRO. And you could find that on your own by typing that into your search engine. Well, we are just about out of time, Richard. Richard Friedman, I want to thank you so much for the work you do, for the passion you bring to this critical argument, and please continue. Raise hell.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Richard. Peter Langman.
Bye-bye.
Peter Langman, you're doing such terribly important work. Please continue, and I highly recommend people read your book, Why Kids Kill, Inside the Minds of School Shooters. You're also a pretty creative dude, I hear, kind of a playwright and a bit of a novelist.
Poet, actually.
Poet.
Yes.
Yeah. We heard from Mo Kennedy just a few minutes ago. And, Noelle, thank you so much for joining us. Noelle Ann DeSantis is the mental health DA for the mental health court system in Philadelphia. And she's been generous enough to help one of our callers who's in a great deal of pain. Thank you, one and all, for the work you do and for taking the time to join us. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about the psychology of creativity. Should be a fun and interesting show, something everybody cares about. Well, to download our podcast, we're at whyy.org/voices. Twitter, we're at Voices in the Fam. And I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Al Banks is the engineer. Thank you. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our EP for audio. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Gita's our producer. I'm the host. Thank you, everybody. Have a good week.
You're listening to W.